Focusing on those qualities which give you your umph in meditation, which make it go along the path very successfully, very strong. It's like the additives to the fuel in your car, which makes the car really buzz along faster than anything else. And those five are called the five Indriyas, the five empowering faculties. And I want you to listen to these today and to look to see if any one of these is a weak, and if any one of these are weak in your practice, it might mean that you have to put special attention on encouraging these, making them grow stronger, so that the meditation practice really brings forth much greater success. Because maybe there's one or two of these a week, you don't gain as much progress as you otherwise would. For example, the first of these empowering faculties, the faith. We always say that faith moves mountains, and it certainly can move the hindrances as well. It certainly can move you out of your bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, which is quite a miracle when you look at this in perspective of ordinary life. But here we're looking at the faith in many things, not just the faith in the teachings or faith in the Buddha. That can inspire you, and that can certainly motivate you and send you on the path. But certainly the faith that there is such a thing as enlightenment, and it's really worthwhile achieving. There is such a thing as jhana, and it's worthwhile achieving. So that there is a path, and this is the path to achieve these things. So it's like faith in the teaching, faith in the teacher, confidence, that this is a good way. And if ever there is any sort of doubt in that sort of way of practice, then what one should do is just to look back and see how far one has come so far. Because your progress so far is usually a great indicator of whether this path is going in the right direction or not. In the same way, if you're traveling to a different location, you go so far along the way, and then you check if it's going the right direction. And if you look at the sun, or if you look at some landmark and find you're going in completely opposite direction, then of course you realize you're on the wrong path. But if you're getting closer to the destination, then that should give you confidence and faith that you are on the right path. So as you practice in this way of meditation, every so often just stop and check how you're going. Is this practice you're doing encouraging, generating really good qualities of mind, such as peace, such as kindness, such as energy, such as the feeling of satisfaction, contentment within? If it is developing those beautiful qualities within you, then you can use that realization to strengthen the faith that this path is worth doing. This path is going in the right direction. So you check to see on progress. It's one of the reasons why in a meditation retreat like this, I really encourage people to try and work hard so they get some experience of deep meditation. Even just the small sight of the nimitta, a little bit of bliss coming up. But once you get that first bit of bliss coming up, that really strengthens your confidence and faith that such a thing is possible, and that such a thing is really worthwhile, it's very joyful, and it's also going to generate much wisdom, because it does generate some wisdom. And the deeper you get, the more bliss, the more wisdom comes. So that confidence through experience is very important. It is one of the reasons why at the end of every meditation, I said this before and I'll reinforce it this morning, at the end of every meditation you should spend at least 2 or 3 minutes just reflecting on how you feel. And why you feel like that, what have you been doing? Especially reflecting on how you feel. Because if you spend those 1 or 2 minutes just reflecting on the state of peace or quietness you've achieved, it will give you that confidence that you can meditate and that meditation is worthwhile. In the second year when I was meditating, I lost a lot of confidence in meditation. I didn't seem to be getting anywhere. The first year was very nice. But the second year seemed to be where it was sort of ordinary and I wasn't really making much progress, so I thought. Until I got the insight came up that, well, let's actually check whether I'm making any progress or not. And I realized that what I was doing was every time I finished my meditation, I just get up and go do something else. And so I just stopped at the end of my meditation, just reflected on how I felt. And only when I looked did I see that there was a change. It was a great change from the beginning of my meditation to the end of the meditation. I compared the mind as I remembered it when I came in and the mind as I could now see it at the end of the meditation. And there was a vast difference. And when I saw that, it gave me great confidence and faith that even in my second year when I thought I wasn't doing very much, I was actually doing a great deal. It gave me that faith, it gave me that confidence to keep carrying on. And of course the meditation went from strength to strength afterwards. Also by reflecting at the end of the meditation how I felt, sometimes it felt very, very peaceful. At the very worst, it was more peaceful than when I began. Simply because I've been inclining towards peace. I've been at least stopping something inside the mind and getting closer and closer. At least getting somewhere. But I also worked out why it was that some meditations were better than others. I looked what I've been doing. And by reflecting on the meditation which had just gone past and seeing what worked for me, that's where I developed all the skillful means which I now teach to others. That's why I developed the skillful means which helped me get into deep meditation. Just with stopping and reflecting what works and what doesn't work. That's why things like being soft on myself and not sort of being too harsh and too critical or too forceful. As I looked at what happens when one does that and saw the tension of the mind and realized that I couldn't really go from that place of tightness to a place of peace and bliss. And realized I had to be far softer in my approach to meditation. And when I was soft, then I got much deeper, much better meditation. So I found that out just through reflecting at the end of every meditation. How do I feel? Why? What have I been doing? Sometimes I also reflected, and so I wasn't very peaceful because I spent all my time thinking about something. Wandering around, fantasizing, dreaming, planning. And there's a whole inventory of stuff there you can waste your time on. Plans, memories, dreams, writing a book. Whatever you wish to do, you could do in there. But be careful, because once the mind gets strong, you get some degree of samadhi, you can hold that fantasy or hold that dream or hold that book you're writing for such a long time that you find you can fantasize much more efficiently with a modicum. With a modicum of meditation. So be careful there. And so you find out what works for you. And also you find out it's working. And that gives you confidence. Also, that when you leave a meditation retreat, just look how this affects your life, to see whether it's giving you more sense of purpose, meaning, contentment, satisfaction, to see if it's giving you more happiness. And then I'm sure you'll find that this meditation, I leave this up to you to decide, will actually give incredibly positive results. But that gives you confidence this thing is worthwhile, this path is working. And there'll be times in your meditation, really deep meditation, where you touch upon something just so profound and so beautiful that it really gives you confidence that these things, these deep meditations, are those very things which produce enlightenment. You know, I was saying the last day or so, you need jhana to get stream winner. You can believe that just out of confidence in me, if you trust me, if you know me for a long time. Or you can believe it because you might read it in the Buddha's teaching. But that sort of confidence is nowhere near as strong as when you actually see one of those states for yourself and have a sense of its power and again its profundity, to be able to see for yourself, yeah, I can understand why such a state is needed to get such an exalted experience of enlightenment. It brings up your confidence that these things are worthwhile. But more than that, people need confidence in their own ability to achieve these things. When I was a young monk, I was hearing from some countries that these days you can't get enlightened anymore. That only for the first 2,500 years, it's first, I think, 500 years you can become an arahat with all the psychic powers. The next 500 years, only an arahat. The next 500 years, only an anagami, once returner. The next 500 years, the best you can do is a once returner. The next 500 years, the best you can do is only a stream winner. And that last 500 years finished about 30, 40 years ago. And I thought, I just missed out. Kind of become a stream winner. And some people believe that. And in some countries, many Buddhists believe things like that. They can't even be a stream winner. As far as jhanas are concerned, it's just impossible. You know, you need such special situations and circumstances. You just have a nice cave, somewhere, not be disturbed for days on end, months on end, years on end. And you just get the right food and have a really good teacher and so on. And when you had teachings like that, it just sapped all your confidence. You know, what's the point of trying if I can't achieve anything? Unfortunately, that I found a very good teacher and a tradition where people were becoming enlightened, and monks would talk about it. And because of that, it gave you encouragement. And sometimes you saw some of those enlightened monks or nuns, and you heard their stories of what they did when they were young. And you realized they were even worse than me. And that gave me incredible confidence. If they could do it, I could do it. And bit by bit, because they started pointing out their faults and all the difficulties they had to face, it gave incredible confidence. Not only is the path worthwhile, but that you could achieve that goal. You can attain all those things. And certainly for monks, I make a great point of talking about enlightenment and talking about jhanas, because that encourages them. You just even mention that word, and then people sort of think, wow, this is really interesting, let's go and do this. Is it really possible these days? And yeah, off you go and do it. And whenever a person has any experience, like an enlightenment experience, or like a jhana at the monastery, just all the monks get fired up, simply because they say, well, if he can do it, if he can do it, I can. I'm as good as he is. And it gives a sense of confidence that it is possible. And it's one of the things which I've been working very hard over the years in Perth, to say jhanas are possible, enlightenment experiences are possible right here, and especially in this retreat here, the jhanas are possible. Sometimes you think, oh, you have to be a monk, you have to be a nun, you have to meditate for a long, long time to get these things. It's not so. sometimes people can get these jhanas just on a meditation retreat, just like this. People have done it before. Not everyone, actually the minority. Most people don't. But at least you can get close. And that's really all that you need at this stage, just to get a taste. You won't get the full meal, but you know, you've got the meal out there, you just get a taste for it. And so you know what this is all about. And it gives you the confidence that you can actually do these things. Of course, it's incredibly inspiring when you get a taste of these things. Because you read in these teachings of the Buddha, you read the old texts, and you find this is what all the old monks and nuns did. Hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. And that you're walking the very same path which the Buddha walked, which all the great saints of Buddhism walked. And you read what they experienced, and they experience exactly the same as you experience. When people in the interview room or monks come up to me and they've got problems with the sloth and torpor, and with nodding, I always tell them the story of the Buddha's close disciple, Mahamoggallana. There were two chief disciples. One of them was Venal Sariputta, the other was the wisest of all those disciples. The other one was Mahamoggallana, who was the best meditator. When he started off, he was meditating outside a cave, and the Buddha had to come to him. And he said, "Moggallana, you're nodding." And he said, "Ah, yeah, I am." And the Buddha gave him some tips how to avoid that sloth and torpor. But the important thing is that there was one of the great heroes of Buddhism, and he was as nodding as much as anyone here does early in the morning. And from that, he could become fully enlightened and a great meditator. So it gives you confidence that just because you nod doesn't mean you can't become enlightened. You could become a great meditator if you're nodding. It might be the sign that you're the next next Moggallana. So it just gives you confidence and faith that these are just small things that you can still achieve. And of course, that confidence is just so important that I can do it. Because if you don't have that confidence that you can do it, then there's no way in the world you've ever achieved anything. And monks come and tell me, and they may have been practicing for years, I can't get into jhana. I always tell them, add the words, yet. I can't yet. You don't know what's going to happen next. And it does happen again and again that the first time that deep meditation comes, it comes as a surprise when you least expect it. Usually when you least expect it, because when you're expecting things, that's a big barrier. When you've just had a rest or a sleep or something and you just relax. You know the story of Venerable Ananda. He was trying to become enlightened because it was the time just after the Buddha had passed away. There was going to be a big meeting, a council of all of the senior monks in the time of the Buddha in order so they could collect all the teachings together. And they decided on 500 monks to meet together. 499 of those were arahats, fully enlightened. And the only one who wasn't fully enlightened was Venerable Ananda. They invited him along because he'd been the Buddha's attendant, he'd heard so much, he had a very good memory, he was indispensable, even though he wasn't fully enlightened. So imagine what you would feel like if you're going to a seminar tomorrow and everyone else was fully enlightened and not you. So Venerable Ananda just tried all night to try and get enlightened. He meditated, he walked meditation, he sat meditation, he didn't sleep. And when it got to dawn, he just was nowhere near enlightenment. And he was just so disappointed, he gave up. And that's when he became enlightened. When he least expected it. When he gave up. So, never think that these things are too far away from you. Have that confidence that it can be any moment that something might happen. So if you have that sort of confidence, it gives you the motivation to keep on meditating. If you haven't got this yet, it might be just the next meditation. And there's no sign before you sit meditation that this is going to be the one. So that gives you confidence that this is worthwhile doing. It's confidence that you can achieve this. The other point of confidence, which makes it an empowerment, is actually to give confidence to the process, and especially to the various stages of the process. And what I mean here, that in every stage of this meditation, especially the higher stages, what I'm going to ask you to do is, if it's like present moment awareness or silence or the breath, deliberately give confidence to that stage of meditation. If it's silence, just very quickly just say, I have confidence in silence. What is the breath? I have confidence in the breath. Or especially when it gets the beautiful breath, an nimitta. I have confidence in the nimitta. Because so often what happens is that one feels ill at ease, uncomfortable with these deep states of meditation. And because one feels ill at ease, one deliberately, you may not see this, you deliberately disturb yourself. It's just the same as I was saying this yesterday, when I've noticed that people who aren't meditators, just visitors, who come to our monastery in Serpentine, it's so quiet there that they start talking in a loud voice. Much louder than they need to talk. Much louder than they usually talk. They're afraid of the silence. They're not at ease in being quiet. They lack the confidence, the trust in that quietness. Just as they deliberately disturb the silence because they're not used to it, so a meditator can unwittingly disturb the silence because they haven't got enough confidence and trust in that silence. So what you can do at any of these stages, you can deliberately say, just to empower your mind, to condition it, deliberately say to that silence, I trust you, I have confidence in you. And as you say that to yourself, you actually give that confidence, that state, and you find you can rest in it without disturbing it, especially when you get to the fine states of meditation, like the nimitta especially. If any light comes up in the mind, as I've been describing during this meditation retreat, one of the techniques which I found is so helpful is to give my full confidence to that nimitta. I trust you. In the same way that you give your full confidence and trust to your mother or to some other dear friend. Take me in your arms, look after me. That's what you say to the nimitta. You take over. And you allow the nimitta just to fall all over you, to embrace you and enter the jhana. So the confidence in it. And that confidence is an important ingredient of any state of samadhi. At first, whenever you get to any of these states, you might feel a bit sort of uneasy with it. Especially the powerful, beautiful stages. So many people get afraid because it's a bit too much. Too much bliss. Too much power. Give confidence to that. The Buddha, all the great arahats, the teachers, they all say that these states, no matter how beautiful and powerful they are, they're incredibly worthwhile. The wonderful fun is for free. There's no bad side effects. You don't get any diseases after contracting jhanas. So it's marvelous. You can just really enjoy them as much as you'd like. So don't be afraid of them. And the Buddha was afraid of the jhanas before he became enlightened. That's why he said for 6 years he didn't practice them when he was left the home and was wandering around practicing all sorts of austerities, but never practiced the jhanas. He was afraid. that such a bliss could be just addictive, or you won't get anywhere with such a powerful mind. It was only the insight which came that maybe these are the path to enlightenment. They are the path to enlightenment, he realized. That when he sat under the tree, he practiced in that way, he did become the Buddha. So have confidence that these things are really worthwhile, that you can handle them, they're good for you, and just that will open the door, make it possible. So if any of these stages you find you can't hold, give confidence to it. Deliberately saying, I have confidence in you, Nimitta. I have confidence. I have faith. And then you find you can rest with it without much problem. So that's the power, empowering of faith. And just to sum up that, it's faith in the practice, that it's possible and it's worthwhile, faith in yourself that you can achieve this, and also faith in the object, which empowers you to go ahead. Sometimes if you find it difficult to get any of these stages, it's a nice technique to imagine. As one person once pointed out, if you can't watch the breath, because you can't get hold of it and it's just too slippery, just sit down and imagine you can watch the breath. Just imagine what it'd be like to watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out, watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. Just imagine it. Now if you've been imagining the breath going in and going out for a couple of minutes, ask yourself what you're watching. You'll be surprised if you're watching the breath. Because the imagination is very tricky. So, you know, think you can't sit more than an hour. Imagine you can sit more than an hour. Just imagine it. And you find you can sit more than an hour. It's just like overcoming these blockages. Eventually, you become a very skillful meditator. Sometimes you don't even need to go through all these preliminary stages. You can simply imagine the nimitta. If you know what that is, through a lot of experience, imagine the nimitta, and it comes up, and you go straight into a jhana. That's a quick way. So that quick way is only for people who are very, very skilled. So there's an imagination, which is a good thing to use in this meditation. Imagine you're peaceful. You can't shut up the thoughts, but imagine you're silent. And it won't be that different than the real thing. So from confidence, faith, it actually gives rise to the next empowering faculty, which is energy. And energy is a really weird thing as well, because sometimes that we think that for energy we need to eat a lot so we've got lots of energy inside of us, or we need to exercise a lot to get lots of energy in our body. But the mind creates energy not through work but through rest, through silence, through peace, through not working. That's how the mind has energy. Trouble is though, when people think about not working, they just the mind usually wanders all over the place, thinking about this, thinking about that. They're still doing work, that's why they get tired. The real source of energy is when you can get the mind to nice one-pointedness, because all the energy of the mind, as it were, instead of being dissipated all over the place, is focused on one thing. That gives rise to the energy. Of course, confidence and faith give rise to energy. And also, and this is an important point of meditation I'm going to put in at this time, setting yourself a goal develops energy. Setting goals is very tricky. If you don't set yourself any goal at all, you'll find that it's like getting in your car and not knowing where you're going. You don't get anywhere. You need a destination when you're driving your car. In the same way, when you're meditating, it's good to have a destination, a goal. However, once you set a goal, you should be very wise on how you reach that goal. Don't keep changing the goals along the journey. And also, just realize, having set the goal, What do I need to achieve that goal? It's like a person who looks at their kitchen and they've got all this cleaning to do. And they say, I'm going to clean out my kitchen today. They think, when is my kitchen going to be clean? I'm going to really clean it out today. When is my kitchen going to be clean? It's a lot of work, but I can do it. I'm going to clean out my kitchen today. Come on, when are you going to be clean? If you want to clean out your kitchen, you've got to do the work. Go and sort of put some water and suds in the sink. Go and wash the dishes. And wipe it all down. Do the work so that the goal can be achieved. So instead of putting your focus on the goal, put your focus on the cause which brings the goal into fruition. It's like if you want to get into beautiful states of mind, they only come about when the mind is very pure and peaceful. So if you want to get a jhana, prepare your mind. To prepare your mind is like having a house and you've got a nice room and you want to invite some friends in. If your room's a mess, then no one will want to come in. Even if you try and drag them, they'll run away straight away. So if you want some friends to come in, just tidy up your room. Make it just so pure and spotless and clean. And put out some nice cups of tea and some scones or some sandwiches. Make it so clean and very, very attractive. And then friends will come in by themselves. You don't need to drag them in. They'll see all of that inside them, they'll want to come in. In the same way, if you want things like jhanas to come into your mind, make your mind very clean and pure. Have this beautiful purity of sila and purity of thought inside your mind. Make it very, very attractive. This attraction of contentment and happiness inside. And if your mind is very, very pure and very peaceful and very happy, then jhanas will come in by themselves. If you want jhanas, you shouldn't go out to the street looking for them and dragging them in. Your job is to clean up your house. And jhanas will come in by themselves. And of course, I think you've understood that simile. But setting a goal, now do the work which will make that goal come into fruition. And the old simile of planting a tree. You plant a tree in the ground. You don't grow the tree. You allow the tree to grow. The tree grows according to its own nature. You allow the tree to grow by protecting it from things which destroy it. You allow the tree to grow by making sure it's got enough water, it's got enough fertilizer. And if you just do that, protecting it, watering it, fertilizing it, the tree grows all by itself. The same way with your meditation. Just give it that peace. Give it that joy, that contentment. Protect it. And after a while, that tree will grow all by itself. The jhanas will come. So, set yourself a goal. Growing trees. But don't go just pulling on that tree, trying to stretch it and make it grow faster and faster and faster. Don't put on super fertilizer because you haven't got enough time to wait to see the tree grow. Allow it to grow according to its nature. That's the fastest way. So once you actually set a goal, one thing it does is give rise to energy. Because you know what you're supposed to be doing, and you know why. Off you go. And in this meditation, every meditation, just today, to try setting yourself a goal, what you want to achieve in the next meditation. But make it a reasonable goal. Don't make it a goal, right, this is it, enlightenment or bust. This is going to be fourth jhana, when you haven't even achieved first yet. So make it a reasonable goal. Look at yourself and how you've been going so far. Look at what you think you can achieve, which is within your power, which is not easy, but which is going to stretch you a little bit. Set yourself that goal. And be patient in achieving that goal. One of the problems with goal setting is that people are impatient. So when they haven't achieved that goal, they get frustrated and they get guilty and they get into all this sort of self-recrimination. That's a problem when people set goals. They're not patient enough. So if you set the goal in this meditation, which is, you know, the next meditation, give it a try. But if you don't achieve it, always forgive yourself and say, well, I tried. I did my best. If you set yourself a goal, you actually find you achieve much more. You go much deeper because you're trying harder. So play around with goals in the meditation and you'll find that it will give rise to energy. You've got something to do. You've got something to achieve. And if you do achieve something, even though if you fail, don't have self-recrimination. If you do achieve something, throw a party. Celebrate. Give yourself some positive reinforcement. You've done something, you've achieved something. Pat yourself on the back. It doesn't make you proud. It doesn't make you insufferable. Giving yourself praise because you've achieved something actually encourages you to achieve it again more and more and more. It's positive reinforcement. If you've been getting up early, earlier than you thought was ever possible, give yourself some positive encouragement, praise. Give yourself an extra cup of tea or coffee. You probably need it if you got up that early to keep yourself awake. But whatever. So this is the how to rouse energy. This energy is there inside the body. It's just knowing how to get, how to contact it. I always, if I'm tired, sometimes I just imagine a dangerous snake coming into this room. There are snakes in Perth, you know, this time of the year, and they're dangerous, and they could be sneaking in right now. That wakes you up if there's a snake around. Or sometimes if it's late at night and you're getting tired, you start to imagine ghosts. Especially these ghosts always take over the mind of those people who aren't alert. Whatever it is, just to sort of psych yourself up, to get yourself going. So, and you know there's energy there. I remember as a young man, I used to go out to all these all-night parties. And I was never sleepy when I was going partying all night, or these concerts which went on until dawn. But then when I first became a monk, we used to have to sit up all night meditating. And I started getting very, very sleepy. And I thought, what's going on here? When I was partying, I didn't get sleepy at all. But now I'm meditating, I'm getting sleepy. You know why? Because I wasn't looking upon meditation in the same way I looked upon going to a party. Again, party was playtime for me, and meditation was work. I had the wrong attitude. That's why I've told many people here, look at this meditation as playtime. And it will rouse much more energy in what you're doing. If you're tired, play. You have much more energy. Play means you're interested. Play means you're looking for fun. And that fun, that joy, that happiness is energy. Eventually, when you start really getting into the meditation, get deep meditation, then that sort of degree of joy and sheer bliss in the mind will give you so much energy for such a long time. That's why when people do get into jhanas, they're just wide awake and haven't got no sleepiness at all. So, that's energy, which is obviously a controlling factor. And just to summarize that controlling factor, empowering factor of energy, play around with goals, play around with play. Imagine you've got energy. And have that confidence there's something to achieve, which is also going to rouse energy. The next factor, I better be going quickly along with these things because I'm spending too much time. The next factor of these empowering faculties is mindfulness. I've already mentioned mindfulness quite a few times, where mindfulness is like the gatekeeper. It keeps control over what you're doing. It's like a supervisor. You know, like a supervisor at work, is always looking to see whether the workers are doing their job or not. And a supervisor has to be very wise, because he gives the workers the job and they've got all these tricks to get out of doing the work. You know, little tricks, like when you're walking from office to office, always carry a bunch of papers with you. Even if you're only going to the coffee machine. Because then when the boss sees you, especially if you've got lots of papers, you think, oh, he's really busy, good on him. You know, little tricks of the trade, which I'm sure all of you know. And a supervisor is always on the board. He knows the tricks, the defilements of the mind. You know the sort of trick when it's sort of 9 o'clock. Well, you know, it's getting late now. I should really have a rest now. You know, after all, it's the middle part. After all, Ajahn Brahm said to be soft. But all the tricks of the mind, know them and just don't give in to them. Challenge them. I like sort of challenging sort of the defilements. Now, sometimes, I go into our centre in Nolama on the weekend. Sometimes I come back so tired. After doing a lot of work all day, all weekend, and I go back to my room and I think, I just worked so hard, I don't need to meditate now, I'll just go and have a rest. I feel so tired. And if I did try and meditate, I'm sure I'd never get anywhere because I'm so tired. Whenever I hear that coming up in my mind, the rebelliousness comes in. I say, I don't believe that, I'm going to meditate. To hell with you. And I just meditate. And so often it happens that the times when I think I could least meditate, I get my best meditations. When I'm tired, when I'm sick, when there's something wrong. Meditation just should not happen in those situations. It does. Which really shows me that so much of these things I can do, I can't do, what's possible, what isn't possible, it's just defilement happening. It's just illusion. So I always challenge those things. So the supervisor is someone who's been looking at this mind for so long, it knows all the tricks, that my mind can't get away with anything anymore. The supervisor knows all the ways I wriggle out of doing my responsibilities and duties. So this is what the job of the supervisor is. If you can develop that supervisor, again, it has to have those two faculties of being clearly aware. So the supervisor is always looking at the workers. He knows if the supervisor just goes and has a cup of coffee for 5 minutes and the workers have stopped working. While the cat's away, the mice will play. You know, while mindfulness is away, the defilements go all over the place. So he has to be constantly aware, but also wise. Wise to the tricks of the mind. Wise to the thoughts. It's one of the defilements someone was pointing this out to me in the interviews, and I referred them to the fact that this was actually what the Buddha said. One of the defilements which comes up just before you enter jhana is thoughts about Dhamma. Great insights and understandings of profound Dhammas. And you're just about to get into jhana and you have all these wonderful ideas and thoughts about, you know, this is Dhamma, this is jhana, but you're not actually entering the jhana. The Buddha said that was a defilement, an upakilesa, Dhamma Vitakka, thoughts about Dhamma. Even though the thoughts about Dhamma by themselves are very beautiful, it's just you're about to attain something really very beautiful, and the mind pulls out its trump card and says, don't get into jhana, think about Dhamma, anything please but get into jhana. Because jhana is a bit too dangerous to the defilement. So they're going to make a deal and trick you. And I've noticed that myself. You get very deep and then the mind can sort of have these beautiful insights and it just loses the opportunity to go even deeper on just superficial insights. They might sound or taste good at the time, but they're nowhere near as blissful, as profound, as deep, as enlightening as the ones which come after jhana. So the supervisor knows all the tricks of the mind, and that's sati. Sati, as I was mentioning yesterday, the mindfulness is also memory. So what you learn in the meditation, all those experiences which you had, you keep in mind. So you become a skillful, resourceful, experienced meditator. You don't keep making the same mistakes again and again and again. This is what sati does. So Sati really empowers the mind because it gives it a sense of like a supervisor who's wise and who guides you stage by stage into the deep meditations, guides you over the obstacles. It's like having an experienced navigator in your vehicle. That's Sati, the experienced navigator who remembers the way, who's always alert and wise, so you never get lost. Sati, the experienced navigator. The fourth of these empowerments to meditation is samadhi itself. And this word samadhi, some people call it concentration. The word which I prefer for samadhi is sustaining, especially sustained attention. That's what the real meaning of samadhi is. If you're watching even a movie, in one sense that's samadhi because you're sustaining your attention on it, although it's not very powerful or deep samadhi. If you're listening to a talk and you're paying full attention, that's samadhi, you're sustaining that for a few seconds. It doesn't really get you anywhere. They can even watch the mind for a few seconds. It doesn't really get you anywhere. They can come and listen to Buddhism for a few seconds. Never gets you anywhere. It's the ability to take hold of something and keep it there for long enough for the effect to happen. So this ability to sustain something, a commitment to it, which can keep you there for long periods of time. That's why when you understand that samadhi is sustained attention, you can understand why sometimes people get confused between sustaining something and attachment. In monastic life, the monks who sustain their commitment to monastic life for long years, they're the ones who really get something out of it. Those people who sustain their desire to reach the goal for long periods of time, they're the ones who get somewhere. Those people who sustain their commitment to meditation, and who meditate for years and years and years, they're the ones who get somewhere. That sustaining is what creates the power to achieve. It empowers the mind. Even with wisdom, the reason why people don't understand the world and gain wisdom is because their minds have no ability to really sustain their attention on anything but just for a few seconds. The mind is incredibly restless from one idea to the next. And you see this even when the mind is wandering in meditation. It never really finishes one thing before it goes on to something else. Even if it's one fantasy or one plan, one idea, sometimes you never finish it. It goes on to something else. You can't even sustain your attention on those things. So how can you sustain your attention on something which will be giving rise to the important wisdoms of enlightenment? In this meditation retreat, because one of the main things you're training on is sustained attention, you should be able to see some of the results of that even now. When you go out into the garden, when you look at something, whether it's a tree or a bird or a cloud floating in the sky, have you noticed yet that you can sustain your attention on that so much longer during a retreat than you can in ordinary daily life? You can actually look at a cloud for many more minutes, but in ordinary life, just a few seconds is all you can manage. You can look at a blade of grass, a piece of bark fallen off a tree, and you can look upon that for a long period of time, and because you can sustain your attention on it, you can see so much more beauty, so much more detail, so much more understanding of what that fallen bark from the tree actually is. It's from sustained attention that you gain wisdom, you gain understanding. Superficial attention just gives superficial wisdom. Usually just names. Cloud, bark, seed, grass, so so what? Later on in the retreat, if you go outside to do some walking meditation, if you want to, you can play around with this. Just stand in front of something beautiful and simple, just like the bark of these trees outside. Sustain your attention on that bark of the tree, without thinking, in silence, in present moment awareness. Just sustain your attention on that and see what happens. You'll start to see just so many things in that little bark of the tree. It becomes one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen in your life. I always tell the story that when these sorts of experiences first happened to me, I was doing walking meditation in this hall in this monastery in Thailand. It didn't have a carpet, it had a concrete floor. And the concrete was poured and laid by the villagers. It wasn't even smooth. We didn't even have a smooth concrete surface to sit on. It was all bumpy. Certainly no carpet or cushions. It was really unfair. Only the senior monks had the old monks had the big cushions. I always thought that was really unfair because they'd been monks for many years. They could learn how to sit on the floor. They should give all the cushions to us new guys who hadn't learned how to sit on the floor yet. Who had all the sore knees. But nevertheless, they got the cushions and we got the bumpy concrete. And when we're all doing walking meditation on this concrete, now you're supposed to look a couple of meters up in front of you and just walk backwards and forwards. And after a while of walking backwards and forwards for many hours over this concrete, just when the mind began to become still and I could sustain my attention, I started to notice the concrete. Then I started to stop. I stopped and watched that concrete. And that concrete just opened up, as it were, into this really beautiful mosaic, this beautiful, almost like painting, of all these different textures and colours, the different shades of grey. It was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen in my life. A piece of concrete became something which deserved to be hung in the National Art Gallery. It was delightful. I never expected to see such beauty in something as ordinary as a lump of concrete. And after that I started noticing, like in a leaf on a tree, you sustain your attention on it, you can look at that for hours. There's so much beauty and so much going on in there. And I realized that it's just too easy to pass that leaf by and think it's just a leaf, because you cannot sustain your attention on it. This power of sustaining attention is what gives rise to wisdom, the last of these empowerments of the mind, understanding. To understand something, you've got to penetrate it. You've got to look at it for a long period of time. You've got to sustain your attention on it before you can truly understand it. Even the supervisor has got to watch the workers for long periods of time before the supervisor understands all the tricks. That's why the old supervisors are the most knowledgeable, the wisest. So this ability to sustain your attention on something, keep it still and just watch, is what gives rise to understanding, to wisdom, this fifth controlling faculty of Panya. And as you watch, especially the wisdom of meditation, if you watch that meditation time and time again, you will get that wisdom eventually, which shows you how to meditate. The wisdom of how to succeed in meditation is something which is not really confined just to succeeding in jhanas. Because every time you become wise enough to overcome an obstacle, what you're really doing is you're becoming wise to the defilements of the mind which block you from being enlightened. To attain jhanas, you have to have so much wisdom along the path. That wisdom is the wisdom to, for example, to know how to use a goal without having all this desire and expectation. The way how to trust the mind, give it confidence. The wisdom of how to be soft with the mind, but consistent. The attitude for the mind is like a mother to her child. You have that softness towards a child. But you don't allow the child to do whatever it wants. You guide the child without beating it, without throttling it. And then I've already mentioned about the child in your mind. I don't know how many of you have already beaten up your mind or throttled it because you're so fed up with it. That's no way to look after your child, your mind. It just abuses it and it never does what you want then. So you have to have that softness to the mind, but that firmness as well. The Buddha gave a beautiful simile about, it's a very old simile, but I think the Buddha gave it first. The right amount of energy, the right of attitude is described in the simile of the lute, like a guitar. The strings are too tight, you can't play that guitar. If they're too loose, you don't get a good sound. So find that, just that right tension in the lute strings, so it makes a beautiful sound. If you sleep too much, the strings are too loose. If you try too hard, the strings are too tight. You know just that right amount where you make a beautiful sound, where the meditation is easy. Sounds good. And those are the wisdoms which make you learn how to meditate. You learn how to tune up your guitar, your mind. Not too tight, not too loose. And that's why you experiment. You experiment not sleeping as much. You experiment sleeping more. See which one works. See what your lute needs to tighten it. And this is the wisdom which you gain through your meditation. And that wisdom you gain through meditation is the wisdom which you're going to be applying to the whole of your life. Whenever you want to do something, you've got to be prepared. Not too tight, not too soft. It's that beautiful middle way. To have that mindfulness to supervise whatever you're doing, if you're laying bricks or if you're writing an essay or writing a letter to a friend. All of these things you learn in meditation, you'll find will apply to your daily life. And in particular, to get into the very deepest meditations, you have to have that confidence to let go of the self. And that wisdom which realizes there's nothing really to let go of there. It's anatta, it's non-self. It's okay to let it go. And find out what happens when you do let go. Then you get the wisdom, the wonderful wisdom, that letting go is the path to peace and happiness. Accumulating, picking things up, is the path to problems and trouble. So you become someone whose life is devoted to letting go, rather than someone whose life is devoted to accumulating. So these are the five empowering qualities of the mind. They are again just confidence, faith, energy, there's mindfulness, there's sustaining your attention, and the wisdom. And if any one of these is weak, it means that the meditation hasn't really got the oomph behind it, hasn't got the power behind it to succeed. So develop these five qualities. I know that sometimes people have said these things should all be balanced. Faith should be balanced with wisdom and energy with sustained attention. This is not true because it doesn't matter if one is very strong. You should never try and weaken any of these. There's no such thing as like faith being too strong, or there's only like wisdom can be too weak, or faith can be too weak. But these things can never be too strong. Samadhi can never be too strong. Energy can never be too strong. If you've got heaps and heaps of energy, just don't try and lessen that energy. Just learn how to guide it, to focus it. There's no such thing as too much mindfulness. There's no such thing as too much wisdom. There's only too weak wisdom, too weak sustained attention, too weak mindfulness, too weak energy, too weak faith. So strengthen each one of these. And when they're all very, very strong, find out the weak point, strengthen it, and your meditation will be so much more successful. So that's the five empowerments of the mind. Has anyone got any comments or questions about that? Yeah. Well, He's saying if the is there a time when it's not the right time to give confidence to the nimitta, if the nimitta is just flickering on and off? If the nimitta is really weak and it's flickering on and off, then perhaps it's best to go back to the breath. But if you're really skillful, even when it's flickering on and off, you can actually almost like jump onto that nimitta by giving it full confidence. It really depends upon your ability to really wholeheartedly give full confidence to that thing. And if you do, then it will stay. So nimitta, you take over. I trust you implicitly. And with that trust comes a sense of ease with that nimitta. The reason why it's flickering is because the mind isn't still enough yet. Isn't at ease with it enough yet. The same way when remember when you first rode a bicycle? Because you weren't confident, you fell off. But when you relaxed and had that confidence, you found you could ride it easily without any effort at all. You just didn't fall off. So it's just like riding the nimitta. You've got real confidence in it, you just don't fall off. Because you're at ease. It's that tightness, the tension there which makes you fall off. That tightness and tension. They're trying to keep the nimitta there. When you really try and keep on top of the bike, that's when you fall off. That makes sense? Any other question or comment? Okay, off you go.